This is 10,000 Hours. My name is James Ilgenfritz, and my guest is Elliot Sharp. Hello, Elliot.
Hello, James.
It's a pleasure to be back here again in your studio. I wanted to talk a little bit about some of the various things you've been up to lately and not so lately, and you know, where have you been over the years?
Over the years, well,
yeah.
To prepare for a long and boring.
So you are probably mainly known as a guitar player.
It depends where you live.
Yeah.
In New York or the U.S., I'm known as like a kind of weirdo guitar player. Uh-huh. In Europe, I'm known as a composer and as a jazz musician, strangely enough. Although I think most jazz people here wouldn't be caught dead in referring to me as a jazz musician. Some of the musicians would, though.
Right, yeah. I suppose depends on how specific their own definition is, you know.
Yeah, well, I think a lot of younger musicians are very open and the definitions are very porous. You know, the idea that there's a continuity between the different types of improvised music and the different strategies of composing and how they all fit together.
I think it seems like that goes in cycles. I mean, I wouldn't say this is the first time that young people have really had, you know, these particularly open perspectives, but I think right now it's kind of a new type of openness that people are listening with, you know, because of the technological things that have happened. People just have access to, you know, anything they're curious about. It's pretty easy to find it.
Yeah, and the mainstream media operates hand in hand with the corporate interests. So their thing is dividing everything up by classification, by genre, by marketing tags. Yeah. Whereas random access listening is going to give you a much wider view of things and allow you to hear things without categorization. You know, you don't just go to the jazz bin and...
Right, yeah. I mean, just the viral sort of structure, some really unlikely things can be linked. You know, in a couple of clicks, you can find yourself going from something you're very familiar with to something, you know, that's completely foreign.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know? And it's and they're very close, and one can see the connection. It's not so abstruse.
But yeah, I mean, your own work is... you know, really had this really multi-directional thing. I mean, in the 80s, you were writing string quartets that were being released on SST.
And, yeah, punk labels. Like, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I didn't see any inconsistency in that.
So, yeah, again, you know, that's that same period. You know, the 80s, it was like that. And in the 60s, it was like that, you know, which is a time where you were sort of, you know, had very young and fresh ears in those days.
Well, I managed to defreshen them pretty quickly. Right, yeah. No, but it was a time when, I mean, being on the radio, I was a college DJ. A pre-college DJ in my junior year while I was a science geek at Carnegie Mellon University. Had a radio show midnight to 4 a.m. and I would just spend hours and hours in the library. And they had an incredible library in those days and, you know, just played everything that looked interesting. And there was a lot of interesting stuff in those days from the ESP jazz records, the Nonesuch Explorer, you know, non-Western music, the contemporary music that was coming out on Nonesuch and CRI.
Right.
I mean, it was just amazing stuff coming out. Harry Parch's label. And a lot of my listening was shaped by concepts then, you know, a lot of things in the air about freedom, whatever that is, anti-war activities, the question of what science and technology were and how we related to them and how they ruled us or we ruled them and how much individual freedom could exist in a collective society. I mean, on and on we could.
Yeah.
But I was glad to be a teenager then, you know. It was fun and exciting and scary and everything. And it made me realize that I didn't want to be a scientist and that I wanted to be a musician. Mm-hmm. It was as simple as that. And I was spending most of my time in the lab building fuzz boxes and playing with tape delay units and experimenting with prepared guitars and extended techniques. Well, I didn't know they were called then. I didn't know it was called improvisation. Uh-huh. Just was doing it because that's what you did. And,
of course,
reading books by Cage and Xenakis helped.
Thank you. it seems like from the beginning you kind of had this perspective of being you know, somebody who was writing music but also was a performer. Like, I mean, you were just showing me graphic scores that date really far back, and I'm sure that at that point you were also really thinking of yourself as a performer and everything.
I didn't have the patience to write detailed scores, I have to say, and I didn't have the patience to read them. As a freelance composer, in a way, I'm forced to be diverse because people come and ask me, would you like to take part in this project? I'm doing this installation. Could you make some music for that would go with this visual installation, sculptural or video? And say, yeah, this sounds interesting. Or we have this string quartet that's forming up. Do you have any pieces? Well, I'll write something, you know, or I need something for this event. Could you write? And, you know, I'm always happy to try something new, because everything feeds everything else. And of course, as a performer, I've always enjoyed playing. I like having an instrument in my hand, whether it's a guitar or a saxophone or even a, you know, a computer keyboard to manipulate things. To perform puts you in a relationship with people, an abstract relationship. It's something I call socioacoustics, the nature of sound in space between people, whether it's people experiencing a sound installation or the relationship between musicians playing music together with an audience as opposed to musicians playing music together without an audience. Right. I mean, all of these various aspects, every combination one might think of.
I remember you mentioning before to me that, like, you were on, like, some of these, you know, SST package tours and stuff like that. I mean, when did you start getting on the road a lot? Like, I mean,
pretty much 1982.
Yeah.
Was when I started touring in Europe, the UK and Europe. And in the US, not so much until there would be individual hits, you know, like residencies, or people would bring me out for a single concert, whether in Florida or Portland, Oregon, or Baltimore, or whatever.
Right.
But then with the SST days, in the, between 1987 and 1989-90, I toured a lot in the U.S., especially on the West Coast. Mm-hmm. And then in the 90s, I was being booked by an agency in San Francisco called Rave Booking. And they had us touring with Carbon all over the U.S.
I see.
And it was an interesting time. We were on Enemy Records then. And, you know, our records were really up in the CMJ charts for what that's worth. And
right.
It wasn't considered as a discontinuity that here was this extreme electric band that was using a lot of sampling and a lot of freer approaches to playing solos. I don't know what you want to call it. It was Carbon music. I'm not going to say it was, you know, this hyphenated with this hyphenated with that,
right,
but it was what we were doing, and people were digging it. It was great.
Right. Yeah. I mean, people will draw their own comparisons, you know, to whatever their frame of reference is. You know, like, the same thing can sound to one person like, you know, they say, oh, that sounds like drum and bass, and somebody else says that, you know, sounds like Electric Jack Jay Jeanette, you know.
Yeah.
Like,
well, you know, if you get into talking with DJs and people who produce a lot of dance music professionally, I mean, the difference in snare drum sound alone will define. You might hear the same groove, but if the snare drum sound is different, it defines it as a completely different genre.
Right.
So it's like, you know, discussions of religious minutiae.
Right.
You know, and gets very heated.
Yeah.
But I try to ignore all that and just keep doing what I'm doing,
right,
which sometimes interfaces with those scenes or with other scenes. Yeah, I was involved in a lot of electronic dance music in the 90s too, and even some of the Carbon tracks were influenced by that. And I had my project called Tectonics, which began around 92, which was very much techno and drum and bass oriented. Well, jungle, really, before it became drum and bass. I was much more taken with it. I thought it was one of the great rhythmic innovations.
Right.
And I was doing a lot of work in that scene.
Right.
And made a number of records. So, and there's a new Tectonics record, Abstraction Distraction, which is the latest in that. So I'm generating a lot of drum loops from sessions I've produced and from drum machine grooves and processing them in the computer and then layering more improvisational elements. And Abstraction Distraction, I only played horns, no guitars
at all.
And synthesizers. Just to get away from being seen as a guitar player.
Thank you.
I like scores that have the same structure every time they're played, but the internal detail has room to vary every time. It's still the same piece, but it can manifest itself in different ways.
Right, like the trio that Flexations?
Flexagons, my new trio. Although it might become a larger ensemble at some point. Mm. But Flexagons is a set of modules, and any module can be played together with any other module. They're melodic and rhythmic, and when stacked vertically, they imply harmony. Every one can be taken apart as well into components that can be looped. So it's just a way of musicians dealing with a certain amount of material that gives it an organizing principle. It gives it a certain unity of sound. You begin to recognize tunes and melodies mm-hmm. in it, even though they're completely different every time they're played.
Right, I see. Well,
yeah, it's very
like
open.
The same material is both, you know, functions both vertically and horizontally.
Yeah. It's very open. It's very improvisational. You know, the musicians are all listening and playing in time. There's absolutely nothing discussed beforehand except how everyone can access the material.
Right.
And you can access it. You might just find one bar you like and loop, or even mm-hmm. a fragment of a melody and loop that. Or you might read an entire line. I think the longest is 4 bars long. Mm-hmm. Read an entire long, chain it to the next line, because you can chain them and there will be sort of an ongoing melodic shape to it.
Right. Well, this is probably, I guess, probably one recent example of something you've been doing for a long time, which is kind of basing a lot of the structural elements on some sort of mathematical function, right?
Mathematical thinking, not always algebraic, but sometimes conceptual, topological. I mean, math incorporates a lot of things these days. Fractal geometry was a huge influence on me when I first found out about it in the early 80s. Benoit Mandelbrot, who just died last week, who wrote The Fractal Geometry of Nature, its first publication was in 1978, but the edition that I came into contact came out in 1985 and blew my mind. I'd read articles here and there about it, but to finally read it in its full force was you know, completely mind-blowing, and affected how I was approaching composing for my group Carbon at that time in the 80s.
I see.
You know, so I'm often drawing on mathematical models, physical models, conceptual models, but also literary, political. I mean, there's a lot of things that come in. You know, I don't see any, even cooking, you know, I do a lot of cooking. It's not, nothing is ruled out in terms of how it might affect one's musical output. These days, you know, I have the band projects, Terraplane, and this new project, the Electric Willie, we call it, Willie Dixon music.
Right.
And Carbon has been kind of revived again after a hiatus of since 96.
Right? Wow.
It was the last time we played as a quintet, and we did a tour last spring and a new album for Intact.
And that goes all the way back to the 80s.
Yeah, the early 80s. Uh-huh. Carbon's first gig was in 1983. The very first Carbon was Rick Brown from VFX and The Scene Is Now on steel drum and an electric bass with mutes that I had him play horizontally. And Jonathan Cain, the drummer from The Swans. And that group debuted at the Speed Trials Festival in 1983. Hmm. And, you know, we were playing alongside The Fall and Swans and Sonic Youth and Lydia Lunch. And that's kind of the scene we inhabited in those days.
Right.
And then I went on a hiatus for a while, and I rewrote all the material, basing it on geometrical things, on Fibonacci numbers, and which had become an obsession of mine. So when the first full Carbon album came out in 1984, it was almost all mathematically based and using a lot of non-Western models for timbres and techniques and melodic approaches.
Cool. Yeah. And then it expanded in the ensemble to a quintet.
Yeah. And by 1987, for the BAM Next Wave series, they had commissioned me to write a piece for a larger ensemble. So I did it. It was the first orchestra Carbon manifestation, and that was 13 musicians. Then I brought it back down to a quintet. We essentially were a rock band during the 90s and toured incessantly in Europe. We had a couple of tours in the U.S., you know, riding in a van, sleeping in Motel 6s.
Right.
It's fun. Thank you.
there's this culture of handling any challenge, opportunities come up and you go for them. And I mean, like, I know there's a whole other type of mentality that somebody really wants to define themselves. Mm-hmm. They define themselves on what they choose, you know, not to do or something like that, as opposed to like how they manage to be themselves in a variety of situations.
Well, for marketing oneself, which is of course what America seems to be about, right. It's better to do one thing. People can say, oh yeah, they do that one thing. And if we want that one thing, we're going to go to that person and give them money to do that one thing. Right. That's pretty boring, I think. You know, it used to be a composer always was eclectic. You know, if you look at Mozart, he was a hack, you know. Someone would ask him to write funeral music. Sure, you know, church music. Okay, some music for dance. Great, mm-hmm. You know. Yeah, you wrote music. Then you put yourself into it. You know, it's demeaning to boil down a person's compositional identity and personality to just a few simple gestures, to say, yeah, you know, this person is all about, you know, playing like a B7th chord, you know, like really fast for 2 hours, you know. Okay, you know, fine, but maybe there's more to that personality than what they're being marketed at. You know, if you can find a way to inject your core into everything you're doing, then I think you can be diverse. You know, it's mm-hmm. it's a great thing. As I said before, everything feeds everything. If I'm working on a film score and then I'm working with Flexigons, maybe some elements that came about in that film score are going to come in and infiltrate and add an unpredictable element to a Flexigons gig, and vice versa. Mm-hmm. I mean, the way I approach film scoring is also pretty much flavored by my work as an improviser and as a, you know, quote-unquote formal composer.
Right.
You know, film music is a great way to blend all of these things. You know, if the director is open, then anything is possible. Mm-hmm. You know, I had done the score for Tony Dove, Spectropia, mm-hmm. which is a big science fiction feature film and also an interactive media event. She could configure it both ways, single channel video or multimedia performance. And for that, it was two different sound worlds. One was England in the future when everything is just broken, you know, and decayed. And the other was New York in 1931, just before the Big Depression, when the bubble burst, mm-hmm. or that particular bubble burst. And, you know, I tried to think of that as a mixture of Edgar Varez and Duke Ellington, you know, two New York sounds of that era.
Right, right.
And have them blend and find a way to make some sort of theoretical manifestation that pays homage or references both.
In the Spectropia, you used a few different, I mean, you've got string quartet.
Yeah, Sirius string quartet.
Sort of essentially like a big band. But
yeah, I put together a small big band called the 31 Band because it was playing the music in 1931. Uh-huh. And with some of my favorite players, Art Barron, Curtis Folks, and Steve Swell on trombones, Rudresh Mahantapa on alto, Dwayne Eubanks on trumpet, Hofstra on bass, Don McKenzie on drums, Anthony Coleman on piano. Mm-hmm. I hope I'm not leaving anyone out. I mostly played in the 31 Band. I only played horns, mm-hmm. Tenor and B-flat clarinet and bass clarinet. Then this, Danny Tunick playing vibraphone.
Ah, great.
Uh-huh. Oh, and I can't forget Debbie Harry sang on one song that, which was a thrill also. I mean, Debbie's fantastic to work with besides being a great singer. Mm. It was funny strategies trying to make it all work, you know, with certain budget limitations, certain studio limitations. But, you know, I'm very comfortable working here. I've always loved being a geek, you know, and being an engineer. And being an engineer is as much a part of my composing work, whether I'm working in software, you know, in a computer, or working with hardware devices, analog processors or synthesizers. Mm-hmm. You know, Harry Partch once said he was a composer seduced into being a carpenter. And I've always loved that line. So I say I'm a composer seduced into being an engineer.
So, you know, the Sirius string quartet you recorded here, I mean, a lot of different records you've made have been recorded here too, right? Like the Octal series and the Monk record.
Yeah. Just set up, you know, I have decent microphones and outboard equipment. Just try and capture it like in the old days, you know, get a good performance and don't have the equipment interfere. Then later, I really dig into the equipment and do things with it. But for some projects like the Monk, which is essentially just an acoustic guitar and a microphone, uh-huh. you know, to capture the sound of it, or the Octal projects, which are my 8-string. And I had to use different strategies using different mixes of microphones and amplifiers to try and make it feel real, or make it feel hyper-real, I should say. It's actually what I wanted it to be. Uh-huh. I want you to feel like all the internal detail of the sound, you know, all the little mm-hmm. things that give this weird instrument, this 8-string guitar bass that was built for me by Saul Cole, its personality.
Uh-huh. Right.
You know, and so the instrument, the pieces for Octal are almost like etudes. Each one explores a certain particular sound world, mm-hmm. and then within that sound world, there's both specifically composed sections and then techniques that are, in a way, seeds for the extemporaneous improvisation on the structure. Yeah, I always liked having range, you know, being able to operate not just in the specific range of a guitar, and especially as I was developing this two-hand technique over the years, I began doing it when I first started playing guitar in 1968, like, oh, let's do this. And as it became more systematic, I wanted to have larger tessitura. I wanted to be able to do counterpoint between bass and guitar. Mm-hmm. You know, I approach it very differently from other people who do two-handed stuff, or from Charlie Hunter, who has a bass and a guitar on one mm-hmm. body. And I did eventually move to the 8-string approach because the double necks destroyed my back. I mean, not only sure. carrying them on stage, but schlepping them around and all the associated electronics for them. And
it was
too much. The 8-string instruments are very compact and still cover that full range.
Yeah, and there's only one fingerboard to have to worry about.
Yeah, although in a way that's a limitation. It's nice to have the two independent fingerboards, but some things happen because your fingers are close in one. There's some things that are completely unpredictable that happen when you're playing, which I love.
Sure, yeah. It's not just like there's two more strings to play. It's like
Well, they're exponential. Yeah, it's not just additive, you know.
Right.
The potential. So, you know, for me, the different projects, as I say again, all feed each other.
Right.
What I do on the 8-string is going to affect when I'm writing a piece for string quartet, and it's going to affect how I'm improvising on a saxophone, for instance, you know, like trying to do counterpunnel things and vice versa. It's a big loop. I mean, it's what it is to be a composer. I think it's not just that you do a bunch of music, but if you're trying to be yourself in that music, find ways to figure out what those core elements of how you hear and how you want to output what you hear or what other people will hear all reflect that inner core.
Well, Elliot, this has been a pleasure. Thanks very much for chatting with me.
Likewise, James.
Thank you.
10,000 Hours. My name is James Ilgenfritz, and my guest has been Elliot Sharp.